Dígríve Cordia, Tá Fáilte Roimh go UCD. President, friends, you're all very welcome to the Clinton Auditorium this evening. My name is Eilish O'Brien, and I have the very great pleasure of introducing our characters in this evening's entertainment. The Characters and Conversations series was really an inspiration that came from graduates themselves, because it's a very common theme every time we speak to our own alumni, in that there's nearly always that phrase, do you remember so-and-so? So that was really why we came to the idea of, well, we should do more than just listen to, do you remember so-and-so? We should bring them back to our own graduates. And we've had some wonderful people over the last year or so, Rosaline Lenehan, Peter Sutherland, Dave Fanning, Connor McPherson, just to name a few. So I hope you all have a most enjoyable evening with our two guests this evening. Just before we start, I would just point out there are two exits at the back, the one you came in, the one over this side, and there's one down here just in case of emergencies. I'd also ask that maybe you just check that your phones are turned off, please.
Don't worry, you're probably far more entertaining than us.
This evening has a slightly 70s sort of vibe because both Jared and Miles are graduates of the 70s from this university. They're also both former teachers, so they may just share a few of those staff room sessions with us if they so choose. Jared Stembridge, of course, is synonymous with Scrapped Saturday and Nighthawks, those of us who just came a little bit behind him at university remember him most fondly for that. But his career spans film where, you know, Ordinary Decent Criminal, Nora, Guilt Trip, Black Day. Most recently, of course, you had Alarm, which is one of those almost terrible movies that has a resonance for a lot of people who are now stuck in ghost estates. So if you haven't seen it, I would recommend that you go and see that one. He also has written extensively for theatre, and his two books include According to Luke and Counting Down. He was also, actually, I should say, while he was here doing his BA, he also was auditor of the LNH, so he's in the history books for that one too. Miles Duncan, another BA graduate, also with an MA and a HDIP from the 70s. More recently, he had a Fulbright scholarship to Berkeley, which he says was the most wonderful experience, and is only sorry that it was only 6 months. His interest, of course, in history led to that Fulbright, and he, of course, is now presenting the history series on Radio 1 at 6 to 7 on a Sunday evening, so I would suggest that you tune into that. Of course, he is remembered very fondly for his arts programs and his current affairs as a very fine broadcaster. I think as well that he's a very prolific historical writer. He has 9 books to his credit, including the most recent, which was Conspiracy, which is the Irish political trials, which takes us spanning from the Robert Emmet write-up to Roger Casement. So I would just like you to welcome our guests, and I'll turn the floor over to you.
I have a plan.
Oh, good. Off you go then.
We should actually say that the last time we were supposed to do this, I didn't show up. So they're very lucky. Do you remember that?
Galway.
2 years ago. It was an arranged students' union thing. And I got a call. I was at home, which is in Kells. And I got a call at about 5:30 from a very worried-sounding student saying, Miles, are you somewhere around the hotel? And I said, no, I'm not. I'm in Kells. Because Jerry's here. And I said, no, that's next week. And it actually was originally the following week, but they had changed the date, and a certain person who shall remain nameless had neglected to tell me that they had changed the date. So I was in Kells, and he was in, what happened? What did you do?
Well, can I just say that everybody said it was twice as good as they expected it to be.
Going to be a lot of that tonight, folks. Boom! Me walking into a brick wall.
It's always a pleasure not to have to share something. And so I had the entire floor to myself. I do want to clear up something about the Nighthawks thing, actually, because I keep thinking there's going to be somebody there saying, that's a lie, it's untrue, because it is largely a lie. I don't know, I have no idea where this started, that I was sort of the head and tail of Nighthawks, because I wasn't. In fact, my link with Nighthawks, I love the program, and I did in about its second or third season, I did a brief stint, literally as a freelance director, directing some of the programs. But I can take no credit, for those who remember Nighthawks and what a good program it was, I can take no credit whatsoever for its creation or anything like that. But it comes from, at that time, I kind of got the credit for everything that was going. Sadly, that time is no longer the case, but it reminded me of an incident. I got on a plane, I was going on a plane to London, back when it was 200 quid to go to London, and all that. And I was walking past, and this guy went to me, and I passed down and sat myself. I said, I don't know, I'm sure I don't know him, maybe I do know him, I don't know, you know that kind of situation. As I sat down, I saw him look around and go, and looking at these situations, I always think it's better to be honest than to be today. Anyway, when the plane got underway and when people lose their, next thing, I saw him approach me. And he said, oh yeah. And I said, hello. I said, I don't think I know you. No, you don't know me, but you're Jerry Stemmer, aren't you? And I said, yes, I am. Jeez, I love Father Ted. And off he went. So I got... And another day I was in a bookshop, and we've only an hour, haven't we? I will stop it.
It's going to be free form anyway, don't worry about it.
This was another day I was in a bookshop, and I was buying a book, and someone said, the girl behind the thing said, I really like your work. And I said, oh, thank you very much. Especially Digging for Fire. I didn't write Digging for Fire. I said, oh, are you not Declan Hughes? No, I'm not. Sorry, where were we?
Career in UCD.
Yeah?
What? Dates?
76. You were kind of ending as I began. 76 to 82. In fact, I was thinking, like, well, 82, was I still there in 82? I don't know, 81, 82. I do know there were three general elections while I was in UC. They were great days, weren't they? to think there were misfortunes who went to college here who never experienced a general election while they were while they were in college. And now we're all praying for another. But there were two. Yeah, there was 70, the famous 77 one. So in
I
a way,
here for that.
We were there in college right at the start of that. My one of my strongest memories about the aftermath of that, because of course that was the famous giveaway general election, is that the most immediate positive
thing. You didn't have to pay rates on your house. That must have been wonderful.
Well, as a student, no, if you not remember, I was this is where I now wave my working class cards. I was on a grant, and Fianna Fáil doubled the grant. Yeah, there must be someone here in the 70s who remembers this. And it went up from the maintenance, the fees were paid, and the maintenance in my first year, 76, 77, was 300 quid. And in 77, after that, the election that June, it went up to £600. You imagine the huge difference for students. Little did I know, however, of course, that 33 years later, Fianna Fáil would be asking me to repay it at a level at which I would say I never expected this. There's always a comeback.
They've described an interesting arc from giving you an extra 300 quid on your grant to the latest rumour is that John de Chastelin is arriving over any time now to put them beyond use.
but so the 76, 77 was a terrific time kind of politically to be in college, because the first big controversy you will remember was the Thundering Disgrace controversy. Where were you? I was like just a new student in. So it must have happened. Do you have any memory? You're the history man. Come on.
It was 76, wasn't it?
It was 76, but I'm not sure how, was it the summertime or, but I remember the very first time I went to an LNH debate, there was a private member's motion denouncing the Minister for Defence at that time, and then there was the resignation of Colonel Donegan.
Very good.
Donegan, yeah. Very good. Yeah. It's imprinted on my brain, of course.
The only chance I have, keep quizzing him. Yeah?
So it was kind of like, you know, coming up from Limerick, suddenly straight away, it was partly what I imagined it would be, but in a way possibly exceeded that. You know, the sense of excitement. I mean, you came from Cavan, didn't you?
Cavan Meath, yes.
So was
the border, the marches.
But I'll let you talk in a second. But
no, you won't. I've given up already.
But there are. No, but isn't it true though that you know, to arrive in and suddenly I was kind of interested in debating. I thought it's something I would be interested in, and I went along. Of course, you know, joined the LNH, went along to the LNH meeting. The very first one I'm at, I'm introduced to all of this political. You know, you suddenly feel you're right in the thick of it, so to speak. And it's just as you imagined it would be. There's all this political controversy going on. There's people shouting at you and so on.
Do they include Adrian Hardiman?
No.
And Michael McDougall?
No. No, that's your day.
All right. Okay.
Tell us about Adrian and.
Oh well, I mean, I wouldn't know anything about them. I just go along and watch the.
Did you go along?
I never aspired to the dizzy heights of office like your good self. The furthest I ever went was I was the record secretary for the History Society 2 years in a row, and times have changed because we used to have our meetings would be in theatre. Was it N or it was one of the small ones. One of the little wedges, like one of those little orange, you know, those orange things, what do they call them? Anyway, doesn't matter. Yeah. So that was grand. We used to have our meetings there, and then we'd have our inaugural in Theatre L, and it would be, the inaugural would be, you know, be a big deal. Somebody would
Theatre
come over.
Theatre L?
Theatre L. Oh, yeah. I actually read minutes in Theatre L, believe
the
it or not.
Society.
For the History Society.
But
I was invited back twice, in fact, in the last 5 or 6 years. Second time round, I knew what to expect, but the first time round I was invited back to speak to the History Society, and so I was expecting I was going to be escorted to Theatre N or whatever it was and would talk to about 70 or 80 people. I was brought upstairs to the, if anyone knows history, the boardroom in the history department, and there are about sort of half a dozen big tables, and that was it. And there were about sort of 10, I think it barely got into double figures. So times have changed.
It's all gone to pot.
I was saying that we should actually come up here, and on the day that's in us, we should do the four Yorkshiremen. You know, we were here in the 70s. You don't know how well off you are. You have no idea. You know, we used to get up before we went to bed, work down the pit for 25 hours a day. You try telling young people that nowadays, they won't believe you.
But can I say, my bed sit in first year, this is where you get the sadness. My bed sit in first year, I had...
Where?
In Windy Arbour, in the shadow of Dundrum Mental Hospital. I was drawn to it in some strange way. And it was the most peculiar, because it wasn't in traditional flatland, do you know what I mean? It was... You probably know it as you go up towards Dundrum Shopping Centre. It's sort of on the left hand side, and it may be gone now. It's one of those places. There was a row of shops.
That's right.
Of course, you lived in Dundrum, didn't you? So you were about to, yeah. So it was a row of shops. Sadly, one of them, not the one immediately below me, but the one below me next door, was a chipper, which was the start of my downfall. But however, in the bedsit I had then, which genuinely was, I mean, you know, this isn't just four Yorkshire and stuff. I think it was 12 by 10. It was 12 by 10, and I had a two-bar electric fire.
You were lucky.
I were lucky, I know. It was just and the electricity was the 2 shilling meter. It was actually 10p. Let's not be totally ludicrous, wasn't it? I still got it. Florins. I had to put florins into the...
I used to put farthings in mine.
but I actually got to know, literally to the minute, how long the two bars would last for the 10p compared to the one bar, and what the temperature, you know, what the temperature is, and how long you'd keep the one. Because, however, of course, when Fianna Fáil came into power and I got my €600,
my toobar was blazing night and day. I was falling asleep under the heat of my room at that time. Where were we?
I think we were in 1976.
And
we were both here.
A question I really did want to ask you, generally, because when you're 17, you know, even though I was coming
Great
here to
Shamsian
do...
Great Shamsian song, by the way.
Even though I was coming here to do history, you realize, years later, you realize how little sense of history you had. And that when I arrived here in 1976, it was as if this place had always been here. I had no real sense that this place was only 5-6 years old. And I'm wondering, was it different for you that those 5 years earlier, you arrived in 71, was it the first year of
it? I think it was the second year, I think. I'm not entirely certain, but I had, like yourself, no sense of history whatever. Yeah. No, absolutely none. Knew nothing about Earlsford Terrace. Earlsford Terrace meant nothing. Earlsford Terrace was where we went, for some strange reason, to play badminton in what's now the National Concert Hall, basically. And it was then the Olamax. And we did exams in the Olamax, I remember. But that was the only connection. And I remember, actually, I almost participated, obviously didn't participate, as you'll tell from what I'm about to say, in the only badminton match that I'm ever aware of where rain stopped play. Or believe it or not, because there was if you know where Earlsford Terrace, the only thing I didn't even know what it was at the time. I only again discovered many years later. There's a Royal Tennis Court. Again, it's where I did my matric. If you go in the gates of Earlsford Terrace, over on the right hand side, further over on the right, there's a kind of a strange low slung building, and we used to play badminton there. And the surface was such that on some November night, there was a lot of condensation and there were pools of water in the middle of it. So basically we said rain stopped play. But apparently it's a Royal Tennis Court, or it was a Royal Tennis Court.
But Belford...
But no sense at all. No, I mean, you know what you know. So I came here from County Meath. I mean, I'd been to school in Cavan, born in Cavan, moved to Meath, etc. So kind of from that area, knew absolutely nobody. There was one person who I was in school with, who was here at the same time as I was, and I didn't particularly get on with them. And so I was here pretty much on my own, but no idea, and didn't give a toss that this was, that, you know, we were the elite, we were the first people to move to this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful Belfield, which apparently had been designed in 1969 to prevent riots from taking place. Apparently the way it's designed means that if there was a student riot on the premises, the cops would be able to shepherd people into areas where they could truncheon them more easily. Something like that, anyway. I'm not sure if that's an architectural concept, but that's what we were told, anyway. So we didn't riot, basically.
But was there any remnant of the, you know, what we've been told about the gentle revolution of the late 60s? I mean, it's only 2 years later.
There were kind of a few of them hanging around on staff. That was about the height of it. Mm-hmm. And there were people like, I mean, there were a couple of guys with great names, one of whom in Trinity, around the time that I would have been here, there was a guy called, I don't know whether Harry, David Vipond or David Vipond, yeah, the Viper, as he was known. And he was to the left of Mao Zedong, well to the left of Mao Zedong. And in UCD, around the same time, you had another one person with a strange name, and that was Julian Vignoles. And Julian was, he wasn't quite as far, I don't think, to the left as David Vipond. Maybe he might dispute that. But who then went on to become a producer in RTE. But I mean, there was a lot of that. But then there was also a very strong, Fine Gael type element, which would have been Adrian Hardiman, Michael McDougall, people like that, who were also, or they would have been a few years, two or three years ahead of me. But they were, you know, they were very much around at the time. And then there was the kind of anarchist element, led by people like Billy McGrath and Dermot Morgan, who would have been around as well.
Dermot in college at that time?
Oh, yeah. I don't know how long he actually lasted. He kept sort of hanging around and coming back, and there was this thing that they had going, himself and Billy McGrath, which they called Big Gum and the Imbeciles. It was a piss take of
that.
Big Tom.
I've heard of it, yeah.
And they used to do it in Theatre L, and more people would crowd into Theatre L than ever crowded even for English lectures. And they would, that was the kind of, that was the anarchist tendency, if you like.
So when you say you came from Meath,
I'd love to say a
Kells.
Humble background, but it wasn't. It was quintessentially middle class. Yeah.
So so you didn't arrive here. There isn't a Cavan accent or lost somewhere along the way.
No.
And how come you went to UCD and not Trinity?
That's a good question. I don't know, to be honest with you, why I went to UCD and not Trinity. I don't know. I actually do not remember why I went to UCD and not Trinity. Stumped.
Oh,
I'm stumped. Why did you go to UCD and not Trinity?
For the stupidest reason that you asked me. I mean, for a start, the slight difference is that coming from my background in Limerick, I went wherever I could. No, actually, I was quite determined to go to UCD for some peculiar reason, because virtually everybody in my class, like myself and Miles, you know, share a lot of odd similarities in that way, in that I knew hardly anybody when I came here as well, because even those, quite a few people in my class did get to go to university, but they all went to UCC or UCG. And in fact, in the Christian Brothers school I went to, you were very much nudged in that direction. I don't know whether they thought it was kind of, did the church have more control over you in UCG or something? I don't know what notion they had. Or you could run home to Mammy faster if you were only in Galway. But for some reason or other, of course, perversely, that made me want to go to Dublin as much as possible. And I have the absolutely stupidest reasons, because I was a young man in a hurry. The Trinity English degree, which was, first of all, there was no double.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the reason, actually.
Also,
the,
yeah, I wanted
was
to
no
do
double.
History.
You either did now history or English, which was I'm glad to help you out there.
Senior moment.
I wasn't keen on having either a solely English degree, or so, but the other really pathetic reason was it was 4 years in Trinity and 3 years in UCD. I thought I can get there faster. Although the later point out, you get this mock MA that the Trinity crowd give you for the 4 year degree. I used to, when I was teaching afterwards, I used to, because I taught in a school that had quite a few Trinity graduates, so whenever I'd see them, if they had MA on any kind of official paper, I would mock them about the nature of their MA was for their 4 year.
Let's talk about some of the lecturers. I mean, my abiding memory of English, for example, was going into Theatre L, and this individual, very, very tall, incredibly tall, lanky individual, I think some people know exactly who I'm talking about even before I start, walked in and started talking, and I couldn't make head or tail of what he was talking about. Who am I?
Dennis Donoghue.
Dennis Donoghue, of course. The one and only. Dennis Donoghue. A man of absolute brilliance and capernosity and all of those kind of things. And by the end of a year, I had heard of William Carlos Williams. I wasn't sure who they were, but I knew all about William Carlos Williams. I knew the name William Carlos Williams.
Did he actually?
Wallace Stevens was another one. Never read anything he wrote.
But did he actually officially lecture you at that?
Oh yes, he lectured first
by the
year.
Well, by the time I arrived,
he was the head of the English department.
Yeah, he was still head.
Right through the 3 years.
Yeah, no, he didn't officially teach first years at all by the time we were there. But I did have a similar experience, because one day a lecturer was indisposed for whatever reason. We were doing a course on Jane Austen, and exactly the experience. We didn't know he was indisposed when we arrived for our normal lecture. I think Norman Hunt was the Norman White. Norman White was the lecturer at that time. But anyway, and next thing, this extraordinarily tall man, and he came in the back door. Which was curious, because most lecturers came in at the bottom of the lecture theatre. This very tall man came in at the back door, didn't introduce himself, and it just said something to the effect that Dr. White wouldn't be with us this morning, and off he went, without a note for an hour, and did that thing which you know sort of in later years. Yeah, it's not easy to do, but there is a difference between actually giving a course, which you have to stretch out over 8 weeks or so of lectures, and coming in and giving one brilliant bravura performance for an hour, in which everything you ever had to say about Jane Austen is said, or wasn't. But we were, I mean, literally the class was kind of halfway through first year, and the class was agasp at the end of it. Who's he? Why do we have him every week? Who is he? And we never saw him again.
For 3 years.
Certainly, I was very glad we didn't have them every week, because I remember asking, in fact, in this theatre, it was a Rattlebag programme on the 105th, Dr. Brady was here, asking afterwards, or maybe even during the programme, I don't remember, Frank McGuinness, who was would have been in the same class as me, what percentage of what Dennis Donoghue said he understood, and Frank claimed that he understood about 20% of what. Somewhere between 5 and 10% was about as good as I got.
But it sounded fantastic, though.
Oh yeah, it was wonderful, and it was very eloquent, and it was absolutely amazing, and it was all, as you say, delivered with fantastic panache. But it was kind of, what's he talking about? Then Terry Dolan, who was a different.
Could I just say a final Dennis Donoghue story before you go on to Terry Dolan? Is that, as I say, he had really removed himself from certainly the rabble of first year and the rabble of undergraduates generally by the time I was there. And in my third year, midway through my third year, he published a book called The Sovereign Ghost. I can't quite remember what it was actually about, but at the time, the student joke...
Who did it in the end? I mean, did you skip to the last page?
At the time, the joke was that it was a memoir of his time in UCD. Terry Dolan,
I got introduced to in second year, because he didn't lecture us in first year, but so at this stage, because in those days the class was sort of split, because some did honours and some did pass English or whatever. So we were upstairs in a much smaller room, and Terry Dolan, I think I saw Mary Flaherty in the audience, did I? Yes, I did. You may remember this. And I think he probably did it every single year, because what he did was he came in and Canterbury Tales. And he started off, he gave us a lecture, and then at the end of the lecture he said, and next week we're going to be doing this, what have you. But the one tale from the Canterbury Tales that we are not going to be doing under any circumstances is the Miller's Tale, because it is so unbelievably bawdy and we're just not going to do it, so put that right out of your heads, and walked out. That's fine. That was week one. Week two, he comes back in and he says, now that everybody's read the Miller's Tale, and he delivered a lecture on the Miller's Tale. Do you remember that? Yeah.
He didn't do it in our year. I wish he had done. That was a
great
story.
He only did it the once. Maybe we were special.
That was a great story. And actually, I was glad we were just talking about Terry beforehand. And for those who remember him but don't know the recent events, he had a stroke and was in hospital for some time. But has made a very, very good recovery, and he's back out again. Mm. And he was also actually, though, very tough in a way I sort of liked and respected. And I believe for those of you who are involved in teaching third level education now, may seem like a lovely distant memory, which is that if you were late with an essay, there was no question that he would even take it from you. And I'm talking an hour late, it happened to me once. He just looked at me and said, no, you're late. And I said, oh, yeah, but no, you're late. Goodbye.
I didn't know that about him?
What?
Oh, yeah, maybe I
never. Late. Yeah. But I understand now, for those of you who labor with the students, that such things are impossible, that you know, notes from social workers are produced to explain that they've had personal problems and couldn't finish their essay or whatever reason. Anyway, enough of that. God, how do you bear students? Really? But on a kind of slightly more serious point in relation to that, one of the things that does, I mean, you mentioned, you know, Michael McDougall, Adrian Hardiman. I believe Brian Cowan was, judged by his age, I believe Brian Cowan was a student here when I was here. Now, I'm not making any jokes to say I literally never encountered him, knew nothing about him. He was certainly never involved in the kind of debating.
He was a TD at 14.
I so wish Brian Cowan had joined. What?
He was a TD at the age of 14 or something
like
that.
I know. I really wish Brian had joined DramSoc. I'd have enjoyed that. But no, I've no awareness of Brian Cowan around at all at that time. Funnily enough, I did once meet Brian Lenehan
because he was very much involved in the equivalent to the LNH in Trinity, the HIST. And may I say now, irony of one of the great ironies of life, he was the treasurer of the HIST. Can I say?
It's a good training.
Can I say, in fairness to him, he left the society pretty much as he found it.
Yes, I noticed you said the society. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, perhaps one year wasn't quite enough for him to wreak the kind of damage he would subsequently do. But anyway, so it sort of brings me to point. Then there are other names. I mean, people who shall remain nameless, but there's you know a couple of well-known economists who were around at that time. One maybe in the audience right now. There was, in fact,
we're watching you, a moron.
In fact, I knew somebody who's now head of PricewaterhouseCooper, and there's people who are senior partners in significant solicitors firms who have been advising the government for some time, and there's any amount of senior counsels, if not judges, who are now judges who are around that time. And it does kind of beg the serious question, which, plus, of course, there is the other side. There is the huge kind of coterie of the commentariat of writers. You know, Fintan O'Toole was here at that time. Mary Raftery, famous for the documentaries on cardinal sins and state of fear. There was Roddy Doyle. Roddy Doyle was there at that time. And you do kind of, you know, to introduce a slightly sonorous note into the thing, it has occurred to me that we are the generation, or certainly we are, again, partly, that have brought us to this, the 60s generation, it came to maturity, but we are the generation that has run this country into the ground, and how is it? What did we?
What are you looking at me?
What? I don't. But it's a generally serious question because it was the combination of me coming here and what's been happening in the country. I was kind of thinking back. You know, back in the 70s when we were there, what were we thinking about? What did we think we would make? Because there's no doubt.
We were thinking whether we were going to be able to light the second bar on the electric fire is what we were thinking back in the 70s.
But no, I don't agree. I mean, there was partly that, but clearly, I mean, certainly people like me who love standing up in front of a crowd at the LNH, we clearly, you know, we thought we were smart boys. We thought we knew what things were about. We knew how to have a good sneer at a government. We knew how to protest about somebody calling the president a thundering disgrace. We knew that even though Fianna Fáil doubled our grants, there was still no question that I would have ever voted for them. It just wasn't there. In fact, that summer, I mean, I enjoyed being that kind of double thing of on the other being part of an essentially kind of right wing is too strong, but certainly sort of upper middle class setup like the LNH. And then that summer of 77, I just finished my exams, went down home, and I canvassed for Jim Kemmy. And I always like to, but in a way I look back now and I thought, yeah, you were being too smart, you know. You wanted it every way. You wanted to be on this side, and you wanted to be on this side. You wanted to enjoy that. The LNH, by the way, one of the big attractions for me was the food. Fantastic parties. I was introduced to a whole element of life that I did not know existed. I mean, I only have to say I'm from Limerick to know that it did not exist. I don't have to say even what strata of Limerick life. But I remember the first time I spoke at the LNH, and a member of the committee in a dicky bow came up to me at the end and says, we're getting together he slipped me a piece of paper with an address. You're most welcome to join us. Because I had that, I thought, grand, this is lovely, you know. And, a student party in Flatland with a few bottles of beer, it was not. I was suddenly introduced. I got a lift out to somewhere in South County Dublin where there was pavlova. They bought me like that. A couple of a stick of cheese and a pineapple. And two helpings of pavlova, and I was in. And needless to say, I never mentioned it to Jim Kemmy that I was there. I didn't say that at all when I was down there. So, but, you know, here was a whole, you know, it is true to say, you know, that we did have a notion of ourselves, of that we would go somewhere, that we were the lucky ones. And certainly, particularly, you know, that at a time when going to university was still an unusual thing to do. You were certainly in so what was it? What was it that so wrong?
Did you get involved in student politics? Aside, I mean.
No, interestingly enough, no.
I accidentally, by default, got involved in student politics. I wouldn't say I served, but I was on the SRC and never attended a single meeting because one of the things, when I came here, I ended up getting involved in a bad crowd. They were from Donegal. What can I say? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do it. I told my mother about it, I confessed everything, but I got in with a crowd from Donegal. And one of them, if any of you were contemporaries of mine, was a gentleman who was determined that he was going to out Collins, Jerry Collins, in organizing the movement, the machine. And he was a gentleman called Ronan Murphy. And Ronan was moderately, from Donegal, that's why I mention it, was moderately successful in actually getting the makings of a machine together. But one of the things he did to me, I discovered that he had nominated me to actually run for the SRC. And in the particular year, as it happened, unfortunately, I don't think it was done on a constituency basis or whatever it was, but there was total apathy. And I got elected without even knowing really that I was actually standing in the first place. He basically came to me
you
and told me.
You didn't canvass.
I was running. I mean, it was ridiculous. It was just, it wasn't, you know, you weren't running for president or vice president or even more important, entertainment officer. That was the one, yeah. Or education officer. Education officer meant you're probably going on to be a politician or something later in life, or something important, but entertainment officer was the one. No, I wasn't. I was just one. It was like a slate of his machine, and discovered to my horror that I had been elected to the Student Representative Council, never went to a single meeting and was booted off. I think after about 3 months or something like that. If you didn't attend meetings, you were gone. And I was perfectly happy with that. But that was my exposure to student politics.
Okay, so you had no interest at a practical level, but did you have an interest?
Oh, absolutely. I remember, I mean, you were talking about elections, and I remember I was here in 73, and I remember sitting over in the canteen, and with a group of people, all of whom were completely besotted with politics. We knew every constituency, we knew every candidate.
Of course, the coalition
election. Yeah, coalition election, when Cosgrove were getting elected. And it was a big moment because it was a change. You'd had years of Fianna Fáil government, some of it minority government, admittedly, but Fianna Fáil government for donkey's years. And this was a big change, and you know, Labour were coming into their own in some shape or form. But yeah, I remember being surrounded by the Irish Times. I've never read the Irish Times until I came to UCD, and you could get it for
Did they have the half price thing at that stage?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
12p or something like that, wasn't it?
I think it was even cheaper than that one. I think it was 10p or something like that one. Yeah. But I'd never read the Irish Times.
The Irish Times or got 2 hours of my electric fire. It was often down to that. And or I could burn the Irish Times, which would do both.
But that was, I mean, that was.
What was the mood at that time? Where did the students fall at that point in terms of?
Well, they would have been. I mean, most of the students, I think, in those days would have been pretty much to the left, necessarily kind of way over, not as far over to the left as the Viper or people like that, but. And it came as a great surprise to me at some point when Adrian Hardiman became president of the Student Representative Council. And I thought, you know, we have in Galway and in the USI, you have people like Pat Rabbit and Eamon Gilmore. And in UCD, we have Adrian Hardiman. So it didn't square. It made me realize that the student population in UCD was a little bit more conservative than I had thought it was. But there was a lot of
satisfaction,
but it tended to be
quiet elation or whatever in 73.
Would they be right in saying it tended to be Fine Gael conservative?
Yes, as opposed to very definitely Fine Gael conservative.
Yeah. Was there a strong Fianna Fáil presence at all?
Not that I was aware of, no. Yeah. Not that I was aware of. It was either kind of lefty or it was blue shirt, one or the other. Yeah, red shirt or blue shirt?
I might recall again. I'm getting terribly downbeat here, but just again, because it occurs to me that two of the kind of Fianna Fáil people who were most prominently involved in, who I knew personally because of debating, and became prominent in different ways, and they were Rory Brady and Eamon Leahy, and in fact Rory and Eamon operated as a joint debating team as well, and they were very much members of Young Fianna Fáil. Of course, both of them died at a very young age. I mean, Rory Brady became Attorney General. Eamon was always a Fianna Fáil, a strong Fianna Fáil backroom boy, and she married Mary Hannafin, so they have died already, but they were very, very, very strongly involved in if you like, the Bertie Ahern governments of the last 10 years, and they were very much they were an interesting pairing in UCD. They were very funny, which again I was. There's also sort of that dichotomy in one's political view, because they were very funny as debaters. Rory particularly was also very funny. In a very crude way, it would have to be said, but nonetheless, he was fine as a heckler in the LNH, and he had a great kind of kind of Dublin voice that just breaks through everything. You know what I mean? In the middle of all the other voices are going on, he would suddenly be popular. So he was really popular with the crowd, and it was during that time too that part of one's kind of philosophical education and political philosophy, if you like, was that central question: why are there people whose politics I completely disagree with that I enjoy so much, and perhaps largely prefer their company to some of the company of the people I agree with, and that might apply for some of the people who were involved in the students' union politics, who were much more of the left, and yet I never found myself quite able to socialise with them in the same kind of way. And perhaps that's at the heart of where a party like Fianna Fáil has for years until they recently lost the ability to do it. But they were able to in a certain kind of way make us laugh and enjoy their company and so on, and so we chose to forget things.
I think it was similar to the disparity or the dichotomy between the Philosophical Society and the HIST in Trinity here, and that was the LNH and the Commerce and Economics Society, because they were both debating societies, and there was, I remember when I was here, there was a guy called Piers Farrell, who would have been involved, very much involved in the Commerce and Economics Society, and he was a very entertaining speaker. And I remember one night, because I used to actually go to the CNE, because I think it was on a Tuesday night, and Friday night for the LNH was kind of, if you were living down the country, you'd be back on the bus at that stage. But one Tuesday night or Wednesday night or whatever the heck it was, proposed the motion, Oscoelga, and did the entire thing Oscoelga, that the square on the hypotenuse was equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides. And he went and he did it all on the blackboard, and he did it all out, and I love this about the sovereignty of student societies. It was put to a vote, and it was defeated. He did his best. He did his best, but they weren't for turning that crowd.
Who went? Did people go to the CNE?
Yeah,
nobody went to the CNE.
The CNE used to meet in theatre, same theatre I think as the LNH, Theatre M. Because the LNH, correct me if I'm wrong, there was some weird thing, if anybody's as old as me in here tonight, there was some weird thing with the LNH, and it had gone by your time because I asked you about it, where the LNH, because of some element of their constitution, they could meet in Belfield on a Friday night, and they would have their normal debates in Belfield on a Friday night. But on Saturday night, apparently, they had to dress up the way they still do in the HIST in Trinity, and they had to go in to Earlsford Terrace and they had to have a meeting in Earlsford Terrace. I didn't attend any of them, but did anyone know? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that was just a... Maybe I was hallucinating. Nobody will admit to being
that old.
Well, no, it's as old as me. Yeah.
But they remember that. No, it was very much just the Friday night, the Friday night affair.
Oh, Commerce, the C&E would be packed as well. And,
really?
Yeah, very much so. Doesn't anyone know? No?
Yes.
Yeah, you're about, yeah. But you see, you're as old as me. I'm sorry. Anybody, you know, anybody who's sort of not in their late 50s. No? Was it gone? Was it, the C&E had disappeared or... That's really strange. Does it even exist now? There's a few people. Yeah, it's still there. And does it have debates? No? Wow, some things do change. Because, I mean, one of the things that that mesmerized me about UCD, and you would remember this as well, doing English, you would always, in first year, you had on Tuesdays, you had a lecture at 10. And if you did history, you had a lecture at 11. And I remember, at some point in my career in UCD doing English and doing Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. And Joyce, i.e. aka Stephen Dedalus, describes going to lectures in UCD, and he had a 10 o'clock lecture in English.
I didn't notice that.
10 o'clock in the morning. It hadn't changed in quite a few years.
I'd never noticed that. Yeah. Shows how inattentively I read Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man.
Close reading of it, obviously.
The other thing that struck me thinking about that time as well is how narrow, in some ways, how narrow, even though I was sort of, it seemed to be fully involved in the life of the university in a number of different ways, and the joining societies, but that I realized that even in the limited number of buildings that were there, I was never in 5 years in the science building. In UCD. My world literally revolved around the arts.
I mean,
block.
You were saying to the president that you knew one medical student, which
yes.
was one
Once.
More than I knew.
Yeah.
There were a few engineers, you'd meet engineers during rag week because they'd come and throw flour at you, and that was about the height of it.
Yeah, and the sports, for example, like I did recall, because I met him once or twice, but the only, it was a rugby international from that time was Hugo McNeil.
We had Kevin Mays. He was here for 45 years, did you know?
And also, I had a brief flirtation with football, however, because I was always a soccer fan and played schoolboy soccer and things like that. And so I tried out for the freshers. And needless to say, I didn't get away. One of the other players remarked somewhat ominously as I came up to him, he says, "Well, you certainly talk a good game." Because apparently I was given to barking out orders even during the freshers' trial. Anyway, the weird thing was that after that, and it certainly wasn't out of pique or anything like that, but I had no involvement, if you like, in the football life of the college. That disappeared completely as well, and so you do sort of wonder whether at that age how things would have happened. And I've sometimes dreamt, because I also thought that when I joined Dramsoc, the first audition I went to, I got a part in a play, and then Dramsoc became hugely important. In my life.
After you became involved in it.
What?
Dramsoc became hugely important after you became
involved. No. It's hugely important in my life.
And, oh, sorry.
But I sort of wondered, if only it happened the other way around, maybe I might be tugging out for Trapattoni. You may laugh indeed. Look at Marino, he never played a football, but you do tend to wonder whether at that point, you know, at 17 years of age, first age, you have if you like left your life behind, and there was something really good that, I don't know if they still do it in UCD, but it's something I really liked about the arts, the way the arts faculty worked at that time. And the way college worked out, that is that your first 3 weeks there were a kind of free-for-all, because you didn't have to you didn't have to sign on for a particular subject. for something like 3 weeks.
That's right, yeah.
You could meander around lectures, and it was the same at the society. So it was this fantastic sense of which, I can do that. I remember going to Greek and Roman civilization lectures and only reluctantly deciding not to pick it because there were 9 o'clock lectures. It was very... And again,
you finished me with history, because history in second year, 3 lectures, was that all 9 at 9 o'clock.
We were caught in second year,
It was that thing. They sucker you in and then they tell you, you're going to have to get up for 9 o'clock That's lectures.
I went to Irish lectures, and as I say, you joined this society and that society. I mean, the number of incredibly dull hours I put in sitting in G102 or F103 or something at some society or other to see how much I was
about my sporting prowess.
Oh, please, as we evolve on this. Yeah.
My sporting prowess was I was on the badminton B team for a year. And I have to admit, aside from the fact that of having been involved in that game, which was called off due to rain or whatever, my only other abiding memory, and I think it was probably what kept me playing badminton for the year, was Caroline Murphy's legs. They were absolutely, she had an amazing, I'm presuming still does, an incredible pair of legs, and that's probably why I played badminton. That's my sporting story, anyway.
Speaking of legs, the Callaghan girls were there, Miriam and Margaret. Or O'Callaghan girls, rather. Fewer people know Margaret. Some people here would remember Margaret, who's just a fantastic woman. Do you know Margaret?
Yes.
She's a history professor in Queens.
In Queens, yes.
Yeah. And they really were magnificent sisters, I have to say. And I didn't know. No, but I really mean magnificent. They were tall and beautiful and sharp. And Miriam, I don't remember ever getting involved at the debating end, but Margaret was a fantastic debater and really knew how to dominate the crowd. What you got? Because the one aspect this brings us up to another thing: the sexism of the 70s.
Why are you looking at me?
Well, you were the one to introduce someone's legs for a start.
I was 70 years old.
You old roué, aging.
For God's sake,
aging.
I had just come from an all male boarding school, the kind of thing that attracts you to certain sports.
But it was very much part of it, and particularly in societies like the LNH, it was very, very tough. For women to have the courage in the first place, and then have to put up with the barracking and the bang and of people in their late teens, and so it was really neither did you. We had 1 year where there was a female auditor. In fact, immediately before me, there was a female auditor, Mae Van Ren, and Mae Van went on to be a journalist with the Irish Times. Is she still with the Irish Times? She was
I'm not sure.
Medical correspondent.
I would have been around the same time that Mary Harney was the hit. First female editor of the Hist.
I'm not sure it was Mae Van the first. No, she wasn't. What, Mary Finley? Mary Finley years before. That's right. Yeah. Mae Van and Margaret O'Callaghan and Noel O'Reilly. Are 3 names I remember, but that is about all I remember from those who who spoke. No, I won't shut up. Go away. All right, sorry. Time is up, is it?
The staff. Oh, we're time's up. All right, okay. Extraordinary. In 3 years as an undergraduate in English, we had Jerusha McCormick was the only female lecturer that I remember, and in history, Mary Daly was the only female lecturer that I remember. Entire staff was male.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
my recollection anyway, I could be wrong.
Yeah. Anyway, it's something much more important to talk about, but time is up.
I wasn't
going to
stop you, actually. I was going to just maybe open it up to the floor and see if anybody wanted to think.
You just want us to stop gassing on, and I don't blame you.
Is it?
It costs in Trinity it's 85 cent. Even better.
And do they still have 3 weeks to meander about a la carte lectures?
They can kind of flip in and out all of the time, and it's not just for art students, which you believe. Like, we allow
med students come over and do a module over.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Business students do so a module in language and all that sort of thing. So it's permeated throughout the whole university. Have I any questions from the audience?
I would, no, it would even earlier than that. I would have done, sorry, I beg your pardon. I did the matric in the Royal Tennis Court, and I'm pretty 99% certain that I did at least one exam in what was then the All-A-Max. Yeah, it would have been 71. Yeah, it would have been 72, yeah. Oh, well, I mean, they were in Erzford Terrace. I would have been happy to mix with them. I didn't have anything against them. Oh my God. Who knew? Oh God. Oh, great. I'm glad I didn't know that at the time. I remember, I am incredibly squeamish, and I remember once doing an interview with Professor Maura O'Brien in the College of Surgeons, and we were doing it in this room, and it had these sort of dark tables, and we were sitting at one of these dark tables, and I was looking, and I was interviewing her, and I had the microphone like this, and when I manifest my squeamishness, I used to, in biology classes, when they talk about cutting open a plant, I couldn't actually take notes with my pen. And I was sitting there like this, and she was talking away, and I was kind of getting slightly distracted. I was looking, and I saw a little bit of, you know, a bit of chicken or something on the table, and I realized, oh my God, I realized exactly what it was, and I dropped the mic. So I'm very glad I wasn't aware of the fact that they were chopping up people while I was trying to do my exams, or I wouldn't have been able to write anything, and I wouldn't have got into second year. There you go.
I think you lost Dermot Moore.
Yeah, you did.
He was very dear to both of us.
One of the things I wonder about, because you can't help but see him, because Father Ted is repeated again and again and again and again and again. So he's forever caught in that moment at that age and then in that time. And I find it hard to imagine Dermot as an old man, certainly, or as an older man. Of course, you know, he would have gone the way of all of us. He would be what now? He would be
2 years 60, older. He'd be 50. No, 58, 59.
Yeah, yeah. So he'd be tipping 60. And it's I don't think obviously he would have changed. I don't know what would have happened in the meantime. But he was. I mean, obviously he's a huge loss. Nobody should die at such a young age. And it was, but in a way, I don't by any means to say he was that this was a lucky thing, but it is like you are made legend when that happens, and I'm only glad that Dermot got a chance to have the kind of success that he deserved before it happened, because it could so easily have gone the other ways. You know, his career had lots and lots of ups and downs, and it had moved a certain direction.
He was incorrigible, though.
What?
He was absolutely, he was wonderful, he was lovable, he was adorable, but he was
incorrigible.
I used to play soccer with him every Friday night down in Killian's, and but also, for my sins, used to write sketches for not one, I think two different programs. On radio comedy programs, and the deal was that Dermot was supposed to provide 50% of the sketches of the material, and people like me, Paddy Murray was another one. You were too young. Were supposed to write. You know, I mean, there were half a dozen other people who would write maybe about 2 minutes each or something like that. The program was recorded on a Friday. Every Thursday night, without fail, I would get a phone call from John P. Kelly, who was the producer, radio producer. And John was saying, can you do two more minutes, please? Because and I think he'd made the same phone call to Paddy Murray and to everybody else. And I used to do, when I was a reporter, when Pat Kenny was presenting what was then Today at Five, before I started presenting it myself. I was a reporter on it for 4 years. And one of the things I used to do on a regular basis would be to do a thing with Dermot on a Friday. So it would be some sort of commentary on the week. And I mean, we did some stuff that was, well, he did it, I didn't do it, very, very funny. But you'd ring up Dermot at 10 o'clock in the morning and say, Dermot, well, I'll be up to you at, because he used to go up to his house and we'd record it up there or whatever. And sure as God, you would arrive at 2 o'clock and he would have absolutely nothing done. And you would sit down and you would start throwing ideas at him. And I mean, it was like, you know, I was prose, he was poetry. But eventually you'd get something, you would say something and it would spark something off. And then it was just, you turn on the tape recorder. You would get some of the most extraordinary stuff. I remember going to one of the many, many years where we did the Eurovision Song Contest, and we went down to the RDS, and he just started doing these voices, and he was suddenly this Norwegian commentator, and then the next thing he'd actually start singing these songs, which kind of all went na 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 na, you know, which they actually did at the time, you know. But he was extraordinary, but he was utterly incorrigible.
I've told these stories so much, but to ensure that we would have the material for the program, we had to make sure not to meet in the days preceding it, precisely because Dermot would spill it all in conversation. And then somehow not have the energy to go and write it down, so we pretty much wrote separately and with occasional phone calls to see how we would go, and then finally would meet. It was the only way we could guarantee that we would have a half hour program, when we went in on a Friday morning. But as I say, the thing that I think about every time I say, and I don't look at Father, I mean, you know, you've seen them all, but you flick and you see, and you watch for a minute or two and so on. And it is that question, like all of us, as I look out here, I'm sure there must be amongst you, contemporaries of mine, although obviously I find it hard to imagine because you all look so much older than me, but that is probably... But to imagine Dermot as an old man is something I cannot do. I cannot do because there was so much incredible energy actually about him. It was always that even though he was grey-haired from what?
Oh yeah.
30 or something like that.
Yeah.
The grey hair never made him look old somehow because he was just this extraordinary sort of.
He was. You know the way a lot of comedians in real life, they're actually not very funny. He was. I mean, he was just extraordinary. Yeah. You'd be down there playing soccer and, having a shower afterwards, having a drink afterwards, and you'd just love to have a tape recorder and just record him and then steal it and write it all down and pretend you were brilliant. That's the way he was. He was just, he was always on. Always on.
I have a microphone, actually. Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just like to ask speakers, who squashed Scrap Saturday, and is there any prospect of having a Scrap Anglo?
Scrap what?
Scrap Anglo.
I mean, quite honestly, no. I will go to my grave. Touch wood. I hope I don't go to my grave. But nobody squashed Scrap Saturday. Nobody. Absolutely nobody. It was. The only thing I will say, and I think Miles is somebody who's worked in RTÉ a long time. Remember, it was largely the time of a single radio station, a single dominant radio station, and there was a kind of arrogance within those who ran RTÉ, to those who were in charge, that, well, if you don't come to us, you've nowhere else to go. And that always tended to enter into the whole business of, when they wanted, money, terms, what. In the end, I'd say it wasn't about politics at all. It was about a kind of mutual arrogance, I would say, because myself and Dermot thought after we'd done a certain number of series, we thought, well, let's wait and see what they offer us.
You know what I mean? That's really, and we'll go off and we'll do other things. And in a way, we were, you know, there was a part of us that was sort of glad with, there's a legend here. And, you know, you're sometimes better off leaving that legend alone. But we could have been tempted back with important things like money. And and it never happened. It never happened.
Shame, clearly, it's too late for that now.
Yeah, I know. And clearly RTE were saying, well, they'll come and ask us, as everybody does, because there's nowhere else to go. And gradually, genuinely, I think that's what it is. And the time drifted on, and then we both, you know, started doing other things, and we talked about it. But we, you know, the more we realised how much people were so upset at its absence, I would have to say, and God rest him, Dermot would agree with me. Although he loved to light the touch paper on a controversy, and it is extraordinary how I have never ever fomented that controversy, but it persists. It persists in the public mind that somehow we were done in by D. And if we were, I know nothing about it, and quite genuinely. I say, well, how could we have done what we did? You know, the damage was done. Doing another series or two wouldn't have done us any more damage. So the real story is I think a kind of interesting story about a kind of managerial arrogance and artistic arrogance, where, you know, I thought, well, you know, myself and Dermot thought they should be on their bended knees begging us to come back. And the management in RTE is thinking, well, those people have nowhere else to go, so they'll come around sooner or later. I really do think it's, you know. And in a way, that's a very Irish story, isn't it? I talked about, there must be something going on before that in school and things like that. There must have been, you know, I mean, you're good at English, you want to do English and all the rest of it. But the moment I started performing in Dramsock, and in a way the LNH stuff was like performance as well, you know, in front of a crowd. So the moment I started acting, I realized there was something about this that I loved, and by the end of second year, something began to tell me that it wasn't really about acting, because I began to realize, even in kind of college terms where everyone's at it together, that as an actor you were at the beck and call, if you like, of, and interestingly enough, my first strange steps into it, I can hardly call it writing, but I created a show around the poetry of Philip Larkin. I basically robbed Philip Larkin's poems and created a kind of a lunchtime show. And I realized that was the first tentative step in realize, no, actually, I don't merely want to interpret them as an actor. I want to create myself. And it's a very, it was a very gradual thing, I would never have spoken it. I then wrote another kind of spoof comedy play before I left college, which was directed by Paul Mercier, those were the first kind of tentative steps. But by the time, unlike, I'm sure, I'm pretty certain Conor McPherson had written quite a lot in college, hadn't he, before he ever, but that did not happen to me. And I will have to say there was even a sort of fear of naming the name. You know, if someone had said, wild horses could not have got out of me, I want to be a writer at that point. Nothing could have made me say that. So how deeply that was buried and had to emerge as it did. Finally, actually, by writing a play for Youth Theatre, for Dublin Youth Theatre in the mid-80s, when I was 25, I had written three plays in the meantime along the way, which I didn't even know where to, you know, what to do with them or where to go. But it was a very, very slow emerging, and it came from realizing that that's why the thing about university life is that my English degree had nothing whatsoever. Even though I love the English degree, I don't know that, but my English degree had nothing whatsoever to do with my discovery that I was interested in writing, but but acting in Dramsock, and probably even performing in front of the LNH, made me realise, God, because even in the LNH, in my second year, I think I became the record secretary. You know, you supposedly write the minutes every week, but actually what you're doing is you're writing 10 minutes of stand-up. I didn't know that's what it was, but I knew I had to make the audience laugh, and I knew how to, and so I started writing comedy, I suppose, at that time. So it was all accidental, and it was all, by the way, and I've always maintained it as one of the great aspects of university, which I fear somehow is being lost with so many exams and all the rest of it, that involvement in the discovery of being involved in organizations and in societies, and that you actually start to find out what it is you are, what it is you want to do. So that's how that emerged. Very long story about that.
You also slated in front of an audience something that I wrote. First time we ever met. Do you remember that? I haven't forgotten. It was the Dublin Shakespeare Society Schools Festival.
Yep, I do remember it.
And I had been prevailed upon by a friend of mine, Bree Jean Gilroy, who taught in Lewis and Rathmines, to direct something. And I had deconstructed Macbeth. And I had turned it into a little sort of a little playlist. And I had the good fortune of having had two extremely good actors, one of whom was Sheila Tobin, who went on to a professional career.
Sheila.
Sheila was Macbeth.
Niall Tobin's daughter.
And it was a bit of whimsy on my part, but it sort of got them interested and got them going. And your man, I was sitting backstage, surrounded by these Leaving Cert kids who were looking at me as he deconstructed my deconstruction, tearing strips of it, saying wonderful things about them and absolutely dreadful things about me. And I was at the time, I'd just taken over, I'd just started presenting Late Date. And I was sitting backstage listening to this, and I thought, this guy is so good that immediately, within about a week, he was on Late Days reviewing theatre. I'm doing exactly the same thing. Broadcasting, though, not narrowcasting.
I was just about to tell that story, actually, as to say the really nice side of Miles Dungan, you know, that I should have pissed on him. And the following
week...
From
a great height, I might add.
And the following week, he invited me to come and review a play. And not only that, but because Miles and I have had these weird connections over the years. That was the very first time we encountered each other. And then you were doing I started to do the reviews on Late Date. But then I think it was you had the idea for some evening program that you were doing. And you asked me, would I contribute a scripted piece? And again, that was the very first broadcast comedy that I ever did. Nobody, who heard them? I don't know. They would have been pieces, a bit like the diary pieces
that Olivia Leary
and Joe Connor do. But they were just like a 5-minute scripted piece. But I sort of seized the opportunity to do something amusing. So in fact, I owe my entire career to the fact that I insulted Miles Dungan.
Quite genuinely,
that is the case.
If my now 22-year-old son has a career of any kinds, he owes it to him, because he Jerry wrote Ordinary Decent Criminal, and in which Kevin Spacey should have been arraigned for crimes against the Irish accent, but a very, very good script. But my son's first day's work was himself and Kevin Spacey. He was the I don't know if you've ever seen the film, but he was the eldest son of Kevin Spacey.
I didn't know that till tonight.
So he wrote lines for it. Anyway, and he's gone on to do theatre studies in Trinity. So it's payback. Thank you.
Thank you, Eilish, President, distinguished guests. As I very reluctantly bring this wonderful evening to a close, I'm conscious that time has just stood still. We've been amused entertained. I think there's a lightness to our spirit and step, and I would thank Jerry and Miles for creating those precious moments for us. I would like to thank Tipperary Water, who are our drink sponsors, for our Characters in Conversation series. If you have enjoyed this evening, our next event will be on the 9th of February, when Micheál Ó Mearaithearteach and Colm O'Rourke will be our Characters in Conversation. But tonight, ladies and gentlemen, truly belongs to Miles and to Jerry, so please give them a fond farewell.